factories scattered around the country. Dr. Sandroni had an endless list of sources. He'd been involved in hundreds of lawsuits, but after 4 months of digging, he was empty-handed. David and Helen had been to every flea market and toy store in Greater Chicago, and they had put together an astonishing collection of fake teeth and vampire fangs, but nothing exactly like nasty teeth. Their search wasn't over, but it had lost steam. Tuya was home now, alive but grievously wounded. The brain damage was severe. He could not walk without assistance, speak clearly, feed himself, or control his bodily functions. His vision was limited, and he could barely respond to basic commands. Ask him his name, and he would open his mouth and emit a sound similar to, "Tay." He spent most of his time in a special bed with guardrails, and keeping it clean was a difficult task. Caring for the boy was a daily struggle that involved everyone in the family and many of the neighbors. The future was beyond contemplation. His condition was not likely to improve, according to the rather tactful statements of his doctors. Off the record, and away from the family, they told David in confidence that Tuya's body and mind would not grow normally, and there was nothing else they could do. And there was no place to put him, no facility for brain-damaged children. Tuya was spoon-fed a special formula that was a mix of finely ground fruit and vegetables and loaded with daily nutrients. He wore diapers made especially for such children. The formula, diapers, and medications were running $600 a month, of which David and Helen had pledged half. The Kangs had no health insurance, and had it not been for the generosity of the Lakeshore Children's Hospital, he would not have received such high-quality care. He would probably be dead. In short, Tuya was now a burden that was almost inconceivable. So and Luin insisted that he sit at the table for dinner. He had a special chair, also donated by the hospital, and when properly belted and latched down, he sat straight and expected his food. While the family devoured the burgers and fries, Helen carefully fed Tuya with a baby spoon. She said she needed the practice. David sat on the other side with a paper towel, chatting with So about work and life in America. Tuya's sisters, who chose to use the American names of Lynn and Aaron, were 8 and 6, respectively. They said little during dinner, but it was obvious they were thrilled with real fast food. When they did speak, it was with perfect, unaccented English. According to Luin, they were making straight A's in school. Perhaps it was the gloomy prospect of an uncertain future, or maybe it was just the meager existence being carved out by desperate immigrants, but the dinners were solemn and subdued. At various times, the parents, grandparents, and sisters looked at Tuya as if they wanted to cry. They remembered the noisy, hyper little boy with the quick smile and easy laugh, and they were struggling to accept the truth that he would never return. So blamed himself for buying the fake teeth. Lynn blamed herself for not being more diligent. Lynn and Aaron blamed themselves for encouraging Tuya to play with the teeth and scare them. Even Zaw and Lou blamed themselves. They should have done something, though they had no idea what. After dinner, David and Helen walked Tuya out of the apartment, down the short sidewalk, and, with the entire family watching, strapped him into the rear seat of their car and drove away. For emergencies, they brought along a small bag with extra diapers and cleaning supplies. They drove 20 minutes to the lakefront and parked near Navy Pier. David took his left hand, Helen his right, and they began a slow, plodding walk that was almost painful to watch. Tuya moved like a 10-month-old attempting his first steps, but there was no hurry, and he wasn't about to fall. They eased along the boardwalk, passing all kinds of boats. If Tuya wanted to stop and inspect a 40-foot catch, they did so. If he wanted to look at a large fishing boat, they stopped and talked about it. David and Helen chattered nonstop, like two proud parents with a toddler. Tuya jabbered back, an incomprehensible stream of utterings and noises that they pretended to understand. When he grew tired, they pushed him to keep walking. It was important, according to the rehab specialist at the hospital. His muscles could not get soft. They had taken him to parks, carnivals, malls, ball games, and street parties. The Wednesday night excursions were important to him and the only break during the week for his family. After 2 hours, they returned to the apartment. Three new faces were waiting. In the past months, David had handled several minor legal matters for the Burmese who lived in the complex. There were the usual immigration matters, and he was becoming adept in that growing specialty of the law. There had been a near divorce, but the spouses reconciled. There was an ongoing lawsuit over the purchase of a used car. His reputation was growing among the Burmese immigrants, and he was not convinced that was altogether a good thing. He needed clients who could pay. They stepped outside and leaned on the cars. So explained that the three men were working for a drainage contractor. Because they were illegals, and the contractor knew this, he was paying them $200 a week in cash. They were working 80 hours a week. To make matters worse, their boss had not paid them a dime in 3 weeks. They spoke little English, and because David could not believe what he was hearing, he asked So to carefully go through it a second time. This version was the same as the first. $200 a week, straight pay for overtime, no pay in 3 weeks. And they were not the only ones. There were others from Burma and a whole truckload from Mexico. All illegals, all working like dogs, all getting screwed. David took notes and promised to look into the situation. Driving home, he described the case to Helen. "But does an illegal worker have the right to sue a crooked employer?" she asked. "That's the question. I'll find out tomorrow." After lunch, Oscar did not return to the office. To do so would have been fruitless. He had far too much on his mind to waste time puttering around his desk. He was half drunk and he needed to sober up. He filled his tank at a convenience store, bought a tall cup of black coffee, then headed south on I-57 and was soon outside of Chicago and passing through farmland. How many times had he advised his clients to file for divorce? Thousands. It was so easy to do under the circumstances. "Look, there comes a time in some marriages when a spouse needs to get out. For you, that time is now." He'd always felt so wise, even smug, when dispensing such advice. Now he felt like a fraud. How could a person give such counsel unless he'd been through it himself? He and Paula had been together for 30 unhappy years. Their only child was a 26-year-old divorcee named Keely, who was becoming more and more like her mother. Keely's divorce was still fresh, primarily because she enjoyed reveling in her misery. She had a job that paid little, lots of contrived emotional problems that required pills, and her principal source of therapy was nonstop shopping with her mother at Oscar's expense. "I'm sick of both of them," Oscar said loudly and boldly as he passed the exit signs at Kankakee. "I'm 62 years old, in good health, with a life expectancy now of 23 more years, and I have the right to pursue happiness. Right?" Of course he did. But how to break the news? That was the question. What should he say to drop the bomb? He thought of old clients, old divorces he'd handled over the years. At the extreme end of the spectrum, the bomb was dropped when the wife caught the husband in bed with another woman. Oscar could think of 3, maybe 4 cases where this had happened. That was a bomb dropper, all right. "The marriage is over, honey. I found someone else." At the other end, he'd once handled a divorce for a couple who never fought, never discussed separation or divorce, and had just celebrated their 30th wedding anniversary and purchased a retirement home on a lake. Then the husband came home from a business trip and the house was deserted. All of his wife's clothes and half the furnishings were gone. She moved out, said she had never loved him. She soon remarried, and he killed himself. It was never difficult provoking a fight with Paula. The woman loved to bicker and brawl. Perhaps he should drink some more. Go home half drunk, get her started on his drinking, push back hard with her endless shopping, keep throwing gas on the fire until they were both screaming. He could then pack some clothes in a huff and storm out. Oscar had never found the courage to walk out. He should have dozens of times, but he always slunk down the hall, went to the guest bedroom, locked the door, and slept alone. As he approached Champagne, he settled on his plan. Why go through the ruse of starting a fight so he could pin blame on her? He wanted out, so be a man and admit it. "I'm unhappy, Paula, and I've been unhappy for years. There's no doubt you're unhappy, too. Otherwise, you wouldn't bitch and quarrel all the time. I'm leaving. You can have the house and everything in it. I'm taking my clothes. Goodbye." He turned around and headed north. Ultimately, it was quite simple, and Paula took it well enough. She cried a little and called him a few names, but when Oscar refused to take the bait, she locked herself in the basement and refused to come out. Oscar loaded his car with clothes and a few personal items, then sped away, smiling, relieved, growing happier with each passing street. 62, about to be single for the first time in forever, about to be rich if he could trust Wally, which he did at the moment. In fact, he was placing an enormous amount of trust in his junior partner. Oscar wasn't sure where he was going, but he wasn't about to stop by Wally's apartment and spend the night. He saw enough of the guy at the office. Besides, the bimbo was apt to drop in, and Oscar couldn't stand her. He drove around for an hour, then checked into a hotel near O'Hare. He pulled a chair to the window and watched the takeoffs and landings in the distance. One day soon, he would be jetting here and there, islands, Paris, New Zealand, with a pleasant lady at his side. He felt 20 years younger already. He was going places. Chapter 28. At 7:30 the following morning, Rochelle arrived nice and early with plans to enjoy her yogurt and newspaper with no one but AC around, but AC was already playing with someone else. Mr. Finley was there, and quite chipper. Rochelle could not remember the last time he had arrived before she did. "Good morning, Ms. Gibson," he said in a warm, hearty voice, his lined and craggy face full of joy. "What are you doing here?" she asked suspiciously. "I happen to own the building," Oscar said. "Why are you so happy?" she asked, dropping her purse on her desk. "Because last night I slept in a hotel alone." "Maybe you should do it more often." "Don't you want to know why?" "Sure, why?" "Because I left Paula last night, Miss Gibson. I packed up, said goodbye, walked out, and I'm never going back." "Praise the Lord," she said, wide-eyed and wonderstruck. "You didn't." "Yes, I did. After 30 miserable years, I'm a free man. This is why I'm so happy, Miss Gibson." "Well, I'm happy too. Congratulations." In her 8.5 years at Finley and Fig, Rochelle had never met Paula Finley in person, and she was delighted about this. According to Wally, Paula refused to set foot on the property because it was beneath her dignity. She was quick to tell folks her husband was a lawyer, with the requisite implications of money and power, but was also secretly humiliated by the low standing of his firm. She spent every dime he earned, and if not for some mysterious family money on her side, they would have gone broke years earlier. On at least 3 occasions, she had demanded that Oscar fire Rochelle, and he had tried twice. Twice he'd limped back to his office, locked the door, and licked his wounds. On one noted occasion, Ms. Finley called and wanted to talk to her husband. Rochelle politely informed her he was with a client. "I don't care," she said. "Put me through." Rochelle declined again and instead put her on hold. When Rochelle picked up again, Paula was cursing near cardiac arrest and threatened to march right down there and straighten things out at the office. To which Rochelle responded, "Do so at your own risk. I live in the projects and I don't scare too easy." Paula Finley did not appear, but she did berate her husband. Rochelle took a step over and gave Oscar a firm hug. Neither could remember the last time they had touched for any reason. "You're going to be a new man," she said. "Congratulations." "Should be a simple divorce," he said. "You're not using Fig, are you?" "Well, yes. He works cheap. I saw his name on a bingo card." They shared a laugh, then began swapping gossip at the table. An hour later, during the third firm meeting, Oscar repeated the news for the benefit of David, who seemed a bit confused by the enthusiasm the news was generating. Not a trace of sadness anywhere. It was obvious that Paula Finley had made plenty of enemies. Oscar was almost giddy at the thought of shedding her. Wally summed up his conversations with Jerry Alessandros and spun the news in such a way that it seemed as though big checks were practically in the mail. As he rambled on, David suddenly figured out the divorce. Unload the wife now, and quickly, before serious money rolled in. Whatever the scheme was, David smelled trouble. Hiding assets, rerouting funds, setting up bogus bank accounts. He could almost hear the conversations between the two partners. Warning flags went up. David would be curious and vigilant. Wally exhorted the firm to kick into high gear, to get the files in order, find new cases, set aside everything else, and so on. Alessandro's promised to provide medical screeners, cardiologists, all manner of logistical support to prepare his clients for the settlement. Every current case was worth serious cash. Every prospective case could be worth even more. Oscar just sat there and grinned. Rochelle listened intently. David found the news exciting, but he was also cautious. So much of what Wally said was hyperbole, and David had learned to cut it in half. Still, half would be a wonderful payday. The Zink family balance sheet had dipped under $100,000 in buried cash, and while David refused to worry, he was thinking about it more and more. He paid Sandroni $7,500 for a case that was probably worthless. He and Helen had committed $300 a month to Tuya's support, which would hopefully go on for years. They had not hesitated to do this, but reality was setting in. His monthly gross from the firm was rising steadily, though it was unlikely he would ever earn what he made at Rogan. That was not his benchmark. With a new child, he figured he needed $125,000 a year to live comfortably. Crayox just might shore up the balance sheet, though he and the two partners had not discussed his slice of the pie. The third firm meeting ended abruptly when a woman the size of a linebacker, in sweats and flip-flops, barged through the front door and demanded to speak to a lawyer about Crayox. She had taken it for 2 years, could actually feel her heart getting weaker, and wanted to sue the company that very day. Oscar and David vanished. Wally welcomed her with a smile and said, "Well, you've certainly come to the right place." The family of Senator Maxwell hired a Boise trial lawyer by the name of Fraser Gant, the number one man in a mildly successful firm that handled mostly tractor-trailer accidents and medical malpractice. Boise is not exactly on the big verdict circuit. It rarely sees the liberal awards common in Florida, Texas, New York, and California. Idaho frowns on tort litigation, and juries there are generally conservative. But Gant could put together a case and get a verdict. He was someone to reckon with, and at the moment, he happened to have the biggest tort case in the country. A dead senator, stricken on the Senate floor, and the cause of death pinned squarely on a huge corporation. It was a trial lawyer's dream. Gant insisted on meeting in Washington, as opposed to Boise, though Leighton Cohn was perfectly willing to meet anywhere. In fact, Cohn preferred anywhere but Washington because that would bring Gant into his office. The Cohn Group leased the top floor of a brand-new, sleek, shiny 10-story building on K Street, that stretch of asphalt packed with the real power brokers in Washington. Cohn had paid a fortune to a New York designer to project the image of pure wealth and prestige. It worked. Clients, current and prospective, were awed by marble and glass the moment they stepped off the private elevator. They were in the midst of power, and they were certainly paying for it. With Gant, though, the tables were turned. It was the lobbyist who would be handing over the money, and he preferred a more low-key meeting place. But Gant insisted, and some 9 weeks after the senator's death, and more important, at least to Cohn and Varick, almost 7 weeks after the FDA yanked Crayox, they introduced themselves and settled around a small conference table at the far end of Cohn's personal office. Since he was not interested in impressing a client, and he found this particular task distasteful, Cohn didn't waste time. "I have a source who tells me the family will settle for $5 million without a lawsuit," he said. Gant frowned, a quick sharp grimace as if a hemorrhoid had twitched. "We can negotiate," he said, a throwaway line that meant nothing. He'd flown in from Boise to negotiate and nothing more. "But I think five is on the low side." "What's on the high side?" Cohn asked. "My client doesn't have a lot of money," Gant said sadly. "As you know, the senator devoted his life to public service and sacrificed a lot. His estate is only $500,000, but the family has needs. Maxwell is a big name out in Idaho, and the family would like to maintain a certain lifestyle." One of Cohn's specialties was the shakedown, and he found it somewhat amusing to be on the other end of one. The family consisted of a widow, a very nice, low-key woman of 60 whose tastes were not expensive, a 40-year-old daughter who was married to a Boise pediatrician and maxed out credit-wise on all fronts, a 35-year-old daughter who taught school for $41,000 a year, and a 31-year-old son who was the problem. Kirk Maxwell Jr. had been battling drugs and alcohol since he was 15, and he was not winning. Cohn had his research, and he knew more about the family than Gant. "Why don't you suggest a figure?" he said. "I mentioned five, now it's your turn. Your client is losing about $20 million a day in revenue because Crayox is no longer on the market," Gant said smartly, as if dealing in inside information he'd cleverly gathered. "It's more like 18, but let's not nitpick. 20 has a nice ring to it." Cohn glared over his reading glasses. His jaw dropped slightly. In this business, nothing surprised him, and he was faking it now. $20 million, he repeated, as if dumbfounded. Gant gritted his teeth and nodded. Cohn recovered quickly and said, "Let me get this straight. Senator Maxwell was here for 30 years, and during that time, he received at least $3 million from Big Pharma and its related PACs, much of it from the pockets of Varick and its executives, and he also took about $1 million from folks like the National Tort Reform Initiative and other groups seeking to severely restrict lawsuits, bogus and otherwise. He took another $4 million from doctors, hospitals, banks, manufacturers, retailers, a very long list of good government groups determined to cap damages, limit lawsuits, and basically slam the courthouse door on anyone with a claim of injury or death. When it came to tort reform and Big Pharma, the dear late senator had a perfect voting record. I doubt if you ever supported him. Occasionally, Gant said without conviction. Well, we couldn't find any record of any contribution from you or your firm to any of his campaigns. Face it, you guys were on opposite sides of the street. Okay, why is that relevant now? It's not. Then why are we discussing it? He, like every other member of the Senate, raised a lot of money. It was all legal, and the money was always spent to get him reelected. Surely you understand this game, Mr. Cohn. Indeed I do. So he drops dead and now blames Crayox. Are you aware that he had stopped using the drug? His last prescription was in October of last year, 7 months before he succumbed. His autopsy revealed significant heart disease, congestion, blockage, none of which was caused by Crayox. You take this case to trial, and you'll get buried. I doubt that, Mr. Cohn. You've never seen me in the courtroom. I have not. But Cohn had the research. Gant's largest verdict was $2 million, half of which was set aside on appeal. His previous year's IRS 1040 listed an adjusted gross of just under $400,000. Chump change compared with the millions Cohn raked in. Gant was paying $5,000 in alimony and $11,000 a month on a highly mortgaged golf course home that was underwater. The Maxwell case was, without a doubt, his ship coming in. Cohn did not know the specific terms of his contingency fee, but according to a Boise source, Gant would get 25% of a settlement and 40% of a jury verdict. Gant leaned forward on his elbows and said, "You and I both know this case is not about liability, and it's not really about damages. The only real issue here is how much Varick is willing to pay to keep me from filing a big, splashy lawsuit. Because if I do, then we keep the pressure on the FDA, don't we, Mr. Cohn?" Cohn excused himself and went into another room. Reuben Massey was waiting in his office at Varick Labs. Nicholas Walker was also at the table. They were using a speakerphone. "They want $20 million, Cohn said, then braced for the attack. But Massey received the news without emotion. He believed in using his products and had just popped a Plazid, his company's version of the daily happy pill. "Wow, Cohn," he said calmly, "you're doing a hell of a job at the negotiating table, old boy. Start at 5, now you're up to 20. We'd better grab the 20 before you get it up to 40. What the hell's happening down there?" "Nothing but greed, Reuben. They know they have us over a barrel. This guy freely admits the lawsuit is not about liability or damages. We can't take any more bad press, so how much are we willing to pay to make Maxwell's case go away? It's that simple. I thought you had some great source whispering in your ear to the tune of $5 million. I thought so, too. This is not litigation. This is armed robbery." "Yes, Reuben, I'm afraid so. Layton, Nick here. Have you countered?" "No. My authority was 5. Until you say so, I cannot go higher." Walker was smiling as he spoke. "This is the perfect time to walk away. This guy Gant is already counting his money, several million, he thinks. I know the species, and they're very predictable. Let's send him back to Idaho with empty pockets. He won't know what hit him, neither will the family. Cohn, tell him your limit is 5 and the CEO is out of the country. We'll have to meet and discuss all of this, which could take a few days. Warn him, though, that if he fires off a lawsuit, then all settlement talk goes away." "He won't do that," Cohn said. "I think you're right. I think he's counting his money." "I like it," Massey said, "but it would be nice to wrap this up. Go to 7, Layton, but that's all." Back in his office, Cohn settled into his chair and said, "My authority is 7. I can't go higher today, and I can't get the CEO. I think he's traveling in Asia, probably on a plane." 7 is a long way from 20, Gant replied with a frown. "You're not getting 20. I spoke with in-house counsel, who's also on the board. Then we'll see you in court, Gantz said, zipping up a thin briefcase he hadn't used. That's a pretty lame threat, Mr. Gantz. No jury in the country will give you $7 million for a death that was caused by heart disease completely unrelated to our drug. And the way we litigate, a trial is 3 years away. That's a long time to sit and think about $7 million. Gantz abruptly stood and said, Thank you for your time, Mr. Cohn. I'll see myself out. When you leave, Mr. Gantz, our offer of $7 million comes off the table. You go home with zero. Gantz stutter-stepped slightly, then regained his stride. See you in court, he said, tight-lipped, and left through the door. 2 hours later, Gantz called on his cell. Seemed the Maxwell family had reconsidered, came to its senses, at the prodding of their trusted lawyer, of course, and, well, $7 million sounded pretty damn good after all. Leighton Cohn carefully walked him through each issue at stake, and Gantz was happily on board with all of it. After the call, Cohn relayed the news to Reuben Massey. I doubt if he ever talked to the family, Cohn said. I think he assured them of $5 million, said what the hell, and rolled the dice with 20, and is a happy boy going home with a settlement of $7 million. He'll be a hero. And we've dodged a bullet, the first one to miss in a long time, Massey said. Chapter 29. In federal court, David filed a lawsuit alleging all manner of fair labor violations by a shady drainage contractor called Cicero Pipe. The job was a large water treatment plant on the south side, in which the defendant had a $60 million piece. The plaintiffs were three undocumented workers from Burma and two from Mexico. The violations covered many more workers, but most refused to join the lawsuit. There's too much fear of coming forward. According to David's research, the Department of Labor, DOL, and the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had reached an uneasy truce regarding the mistreatment of illegal immigrants. The steadfast principle of unhindered access to justice overrode, slightly, the country's need to regulate immigration. Therefore, an undocumented worker courageous enough to fight a crooked employer would not be subjected to scrutiny by ICE, at least not while engaged in the labor dispute. David explained this repeatedly to the workers, and the Burmese, with So Kang's prodding, eventually found the nerve to file suit. Others, from Mexico and Guatemala, were too frightened by the idea of risking what little money they were being paid. One of the Burmese workers estimated there were at least 30 men, all of them thought to be undocumented, being paid $200 a week in cash for 80 hours or more of hard labor. The potential damages were impressive. The minimum wage was $8.25, and federal law also required $12.38 for any hour over 40 per week. For 80 hours, each worker was due $825.20 per week, or $625.20 more than he was being paid, though exact dates were hard to pin down. David's best guess was that the current scam by Cicero Pipe had been underway for at least 30 weeks. The law allowed liquidated damages of twice the unpaid wages, so each of his five clients was entitled to about $37,500. The law also allowed the judge to impose court costs and attorney's fees on a defendant found liable. Oscar reluctantly agreed to allow David to file the lawsuit. Wally could not be found. He was burning up the streets looking for large people. 3 days after the lawsuit was filed, an anonymous caller threatened to cut David's throat if the lawsuit was not dismissed immediately. David reported the call to the police. Oscar advised him to purchase a handgun and keep it in his briefcase. David refused. The following day, an anonymous letter threatened his life and named his pals: Oscar Finley, Wally Figg, even Rochelle Gibson. The thug walked briskly along Preston as if hurrying home at such a late hour. It was just after 2 a.m., the late July air still thick and warm. Male, white, age 30, an impressive rap sheet and not much between the ears. Slung over his shoulder was a cheap gym bag, and inside was a 2-liter plastic jug of gasoline, tightly sealed. He took a quick right and darted low onto the narrow porch of the law office. All lights were off, inside and out. Preston was asleep. Even the massage parlor had finally wound down. If AC had been awake, he might have heard the slight rattle of the doorknob as the thug gently checked to see if someone had forgotten to lock up. The lock had not been forgotten. AC was asleep in the kitchen. Oscar, though, was awake on the sofa in his pajamas under a quilt, thinking about how happy he'd become since moving out. The thug eased along the front porch, stepped down, and scooted low around the building until he came to the back door. His strategy was to get inside and detonate his crude little bomb. 2 liters of gasoline on a wooden floor with curtains and books nearby would gut the old house before a fire crew got there. He shook the door. It, too, was locked, then quickly jimmied it with a screwdriver. It swung open as he took one step inside. Everything was dark. A dog growled, then 2 extremely loud shots rang out. The thug screamed and fell off the back steps into a small, neglected flower bed. Oscar stood over him. A quick glance revealed a wound just above his right knee. "Don't, please," the thug begged. Carefully, coldly, Oscar shot him in the other leg. 2 hours later, Oscar, partially dressed now, was chatting with 2 policemen at the table. All 3 were sipping coffee. The thug was at the hospital in surgery. 2 damaged legs, but no chance of dying. His name was Justin Bardall, and when he wasn't playing with fire and getting shot, he operated a bulldozer for Cicero Pipe. "Idiots, idiots, idiots," Oscar kept saying. "But he wasn't supposed to get caught," said one of the cops, laughing. At that moment, 2 detectives were in Evanston knocking on the door of the man who owned Cicero Pipe. It was the beginning of a long day for him. Oscar explained that he was going through a divorce and looking for an apartment. When he wasn't at a hotel, he slept on the office sofa. "I've owned this place for 21 years," he said. He knew one of the cops and had seen the other one around. Neither had the slightest concern over the shooting. It was a clear-cut case of protecting one's property, though Oscar's narrative omitted the unnecessary wounding of the second leg. In addition to the 2-liter bottle of gas, the gym bag contained a strip of cotton cloth doused with what appeared to be kerosene and several strips of cardboard. It was a modified Molotov cocktail, but not one to be tossed. The police guessed that the cardboard was to be used as kindling. It was a laughable effort at arson, but then it doesn't take a genius to start a fire. While they chatted, a television news van parked on the street in front of the office. Oscar put on his tie and got himself filmed. A few hours later, during the 4th firm meeting, David took the news hard, but still insisted he would not carry a gun. Rochelle kept a cheap pistol in her purse, so 3 of the 4 were armed. Reporters were calling. The story was growing by the moment. "Remember," Wally repeated to his colleagues, "we're a boutique firm specializing in Crayox cases. Everybody got that?" "Yeah, yeah," Oscar chimed in. "And what about Burmese labor law violations?" "That too." The meeting broke up when a reporter banged on the front door. It was soon evident that no law would be practiced that day at Finley and Fig. David and Oscar talked to the Tribune and the Sun-Times. Details were being passed along. Mr. Bardell was out of surgery, locked in his room and not talking to anyone but his lawyer. The owner of Cicero Pipe and 2 of his superintendents had been arrested and released on bail. The general contractor on the water treatment project was a blue-chip firm out of Milwaukee, and it was promising to investigate matters quickly and thoroughly. The job site was shut down. No undocumented worker would go near it. David finally left before noon, quietly informing Rochelle he was needed in court somewhere. He drove home, collected Helen, who was looking more pregnant by the day, and took her to lunch. He explained recent events, the death threats, the thug and his intentions, Oscar and his defense of the firm, and the growing interest from the press. He downplayed any danger and assured her the FBI was on top of things. "Are you worried?" she asked. "Not at all," he said unconvincingly, "but there could be something in the papers tomorrow." Indeed there was. Big photos of Oscar in the metro sections of both the Tribune and the Sun-Times. In all fairness to the press, how many stories do you get wherein an old lawyer is bunking at his office and shoots an intruder who's carrying a Molotov cocktail designed to burn down the building in retaliation for the firm's filing of a wage dispute involving undocumented workers who are being abused by a company that, years ago, had links to organized crime? Oscar was being portrayed as a fearless gunslinger from the Southwest Side, and, by the way, one of the country's leading mass tort specialists in the assault on Varick Labs and its dreadful drug Crayox. The Tribune ran a smaller photo of David, as well as shots of the owner of Cicero Pipe and his lieutenants, as they were being hauled into jail. The entire alphabet was rushing in. FBI, DOL, ICE, INS, OSHA, DHS, Homeland Security, OFCCP, Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs, and most had something to say to the reporters. The job site was shut down for the second day, and the prime contractor was screaming. Finley and Fig was again besieged by reporters, investigators, Crayox hopefuls, and more than the usual riffraff from the street. Oscar, Wally, and Rochelle kept their weapons close. Young David remained blissfully naive. 2 weeks later, Justin Bardall left the hospital in a wheelchair. He and his boss, along with one other, had been indicted on numerous charges by a federal grand jury, and their lawyers were already discussing the possibility of plea bargains. His left fibula was shattered, and more surgery would be needed, but his doctors expected a full recovery with time. He had mentioned to his lawyers, his boss, and the police that the shattering of his left fibula had been unnecessary. The shot was taken after he'd been wounded and was no longer a threat, but he found no sympathy. The general reaction could be summed up by a detective who said, "You're lucky he didn't blow your head off." Chapter 30. Jerry Alessandros finally made good on a promise. He was extremely busy organizing the settlement negotiations, and according to the associate Wally spoke to, he, Jerry, simply didn't have the time to spend on the phone with the dozens of lawyers he was juggling. But in the third week of July, he finally sent in the experts. The company's name was meaningless. Alliance Diagnostic Group, or ADG as it preferred to be called. As best Wally could tell, ADG was an Atlanta-based team of medical technicians who did nothing but travel the country running tests on people who were clamoring to profit from Jerry's latest mass tort attack. As instructed, Wally rented 2,000 square feet in a dingy strip mall, a space that had once housed a low-end pet supply store. He hired a contractor to erect walls and doors and a cleaning service to fix things up. The front windows were covered with brown paper. There was no signage. He rented a few cheap chairs and tables and a desk and installed a phone and a copier. All bills were sent by Wally to an assistant in Jerry's firm who did nothing but keep the books dealing with the Crayox litigation. When the space was ready, ADG moved in and went to work. Its team consisted of three technicians, all properly attired in aqua surgical scrubs. Each had a stethoscope. They looked so official that even Wally at first figured they were highly skilled and credentialed. They were not, but they had tested thousands of potential plaintiffs. Their leader was Dr. Borzov, a cardiologist from Russia who had made a lot of money diagnosing patients/clients for Jerry Alessandros and a dozen other trial lawyers around the country. Dr. Borzov rarely saw an obese person who wasn't suffering from a significant medical problem that could be pinned on the mass tort drug of the month. He never testified in court. His accent was too thick and his resume was too thin, but he was worth his weight in gold in the screening rooms. David, because he was the de facto paralegal for all, now, 430 non-death Crayox clients, and Wally, because he had hustled them all together, were both present when ADG began its assembly line. On schedule, three clients arrived at 8 a.m. and were greeted with coffee. Wally, and a cute ADG technician in scrubs and white rubber hospital clogs. The paperwork took 10 minutes and was primarily designed to ensure that the client had indeed taken Crayox for more than 6 months. The first client was led into another room where ADG had installed its own echocardiogram and two other technicians were waiting. One explained the procedure. "We're just taking a digital picture of your heart," while the other helped the client onto an official, heavily fortified hospital bed that ADG hauled around the country, along with the echocardiogram. As they probed the patient's chest with the sonar, Dr. Borzov entered the room and nodded slightly at the patient. His bedside manner was never reassuring, but then he had no real patients. He wore a full-length white exam coat, had his name stenciled above the left pocket, and had his own stethoscope for good measure and effect, and when he spoke, his accent conveyed a sense of expertise. He studied the screen, frowned because he always frowned, then left the room. The assault on Crayox was fueled by research purporting to show that the drug weakened the seals around the aortic valve, thus causing a decrease in mitral valve regurgitation. The echocardiogram measured aortic sufficiency, and a decrease of 30% was excellent news for the lawyers. Dr. Borzov reviewed the graphs immediately, always eager to find another weakened aortic valve. Each exam took 20 minutes, so they did three per hour, about 25 each day, 6 days a week. Wally had leased the space for a month. ADG billed the Zell and Potter Finley and Figg litigation account $1,000 for each exam, with the bills going to Jerry in Florida. Before that stop, ADG and Dr. Borzov had been in Charleston and Buffalo. From Chicago, they were headed to Memphis, then Little Rock. Another ADG unit was covering the West Coast with a Serbian doctor reading the graphs. Another was harvesting gold in Texas. The Zell and Potter Crayox web covered 40 states, 75 lawyers, and almost 80,000 clients. To avoid the chaos of the office, David hung around the strip mall and chatted with his clients, none of whom he'd ever met. Generally speaking, they were happy to be there, worried about whatever damage the drug had done to their hearts, hopeful of some type of recovery, overweight and terribly out of shape, but pleasant enough. Black, white, old, young, male, female, obesity and high cholesterol ran the gamut. Every client he spoke to had been thrilled with the drug, delighted with its results, and was now anxious about finding a replacement. Gradually, David chatted up the ADG technicians and learned something of their work, though they were fairly close-mouthed. Dr. Borzov would hardly speak to him. After hanging around for 3 days, David could tell that the ADG team was not pleased with their testing. Their $1,000 exams were producing little evidence of aortic insufficiency, but there were a few potential cases. On the fourth day, the air conditioning system crashed and Wally's rented space turned into a sweatshop. It was August, temperature above 90, and when the landlord refused to return calls, the ADG crew threatened to leave. Wally hauled in box fans and ice cream and begged them to stay and finish the screening. They plowed on, the 20-minute exams becoming 15, then 10, with Borzov barely scanning the graphs on the sidewalk while he smoked cigarettes. Judge Seawright set the hearing for August 10th, the last possible date on any judge's calendar before the system shut down for summer vacation. There were no motions pending, no fights brewing. All discovery had proceeded with remarkable cooperation. Varick Labs, so far, had been unduly forthcoming with documents, witnesses, and experts. Nadine Karras had filed only a handful of benign motions, all of which the judge quickly dispensed with. On the plaintiff's side, the Zell and Potter lawyers had been remarkably efficient with their requests and filings. Seawright was monitoring the settlement gossip. His clerks scoured the financial press and watched the serious bloggers. Varick Labs had issued no formal statement regarding settlement, but it was obvious the company knew how to leak. Its share price dipped as low as $24.50, but the buzz about a massive settlement had moved it back to $30. When the two packs of lawyers were in place, Judge Seawright assumed the bench and welcomed everyone. He apologized for calling the hearing in August, the most difficult month of the year for busy people, but he felt strongly that the two sides should get together before everyone scattered. He quickly went through his discovery checklist to make sure both sides were behaving. There were no complaints. Jerry Alessandros and Nadine Karras were so polite to each other, it was almost silly. Wally sat to Jerry's right, as if he would be the go-to guy in a courtroom brawl. Behind him, and wedged among a group of Zell and Potter lawyers, were David and Oscar. Since the shooting and the publicity, Oscar was getting out more, enjoying the attention. He was also smiling and already considered himself a bachelor. Changing subjects, Judge Seawright said, "I'm hearing a lot of chatter about a settlement, one big global settlement, as they're called these days in this business. I want to know what's going on. As fast as this particular case has come together, it is now in a posture to be placed on my trial calendar. However, if a settlement is likely, then why bother? Can you shed any light on this issue, Ms. Karras?" She stood, all eyes on her, and took a few elegant steps to the podium. "Your Honor, as you probably know, Varick Labs has been involved in a number of complicated lawsuits, and the company has its own way of approaching a settlement that involves many plaintiffs. I have not been authorized to initiate negotiations in the Klopek case, nor have I been authorized by my client to make public statements on the issue of settlement. As far as I'm concerned, we're preparing for trial." "Fair enough. Mr. Alessandros?" They exchanged places at the podium, and Jerry offered up a sappy smile. Likewise, Your Honor, we are preparing for trial in this case. However, I must say that I, as a member of the Plaintiff's Litigation Committee, have had several informal and quite preliminary conversations with the company regarding a global settlement. I believe Ms. Karras is aware that these conversations are taking place, but, as she said, she has not been authorized to discuss them. I don't represent Varick, so I'm not burdened with such constraints. However, the company has not requested that I remain silent about our discussions. In addition, Your Honor, if we reach the point of formal negotiations, I doubt that Ms. Karras will be involved. I know from prior experience that Varick handles these in-house. Do you anticipate formal negotiations? Asked Seawright. There was a long pause as many held their breath. Nadine Karras managed to look curious, though she had a clear view of the big picture. No one else in the courtroom did. Wally's heart was racing as he tasted the words, formal negotiations. Jerry shifted weight a few times, then finally said, Judge, I don't want to get quoted, so I'll go the safe route and say that I'm not sure. So you and Ms. Karras cannot give me any guidance on the issue of settlement, Seawright said with a hint of frustration. Both lawyers shook their heads. Nadine knew damn well the case wouldn't be settled. Jerry was almost positive that it would. Neither, though, could play his or her hand, and truthfully and ethically, the judge did not have the right to know their strategies outside the courtroom. His job was to referee a fair trial, not monitor settlements. Jerry returned to his seat, and Judge Seawright changed subjects again. I'm looking at October 17th, a Monday, as a trial date. I anticipate the trial will last no longer than 2 weeks. A dozen lawyers were instantly looking at their calendars, all frowning. If you have a conflict, it had better be a good one, he said. Mr. Alessandros? Jerry stood slowly, holding a small leather appointment book. Well, Judge, that would mean that we're going to trial 10 months after the lawsuit was filed. That's pretty quick, don't you think? Indeed it is, Mr. Alessandros. 11 months is about my average. I don't allow my cases to grow stale. What's your conflict? No conflict, Judge, but I'm more concerned with having sufficient time to prepare, that's all. Hogwash. Discovery is almost complete. You have your experts. The defendant has its experts. God knows both sides have enough legal talent. October 17 is 68 days away. That should be a piece of cake for a litigator of your reputation, Mr. Alessandros. What a show, thought Wally. This case and all the others would be settled in a month. What about the defense, Ms. Karras? Seawright asked. We have some conflicts, Your Honor, she said, but nothing that we cannot work around. Very well. The case of Klopek versus Varick Labs is hereby set for jury trial on October 17. Pending a disaster, there will be no delays, no continuances, so don't even bother to ask. He tapped his gavel on the bench and said, Court's adjourned. Thank you. Chapter 31. News of the trial date swept through the financial press and was all over the internet. The story was spun various ways, but in general, it looked as though Varick was being frog-marched into a federal courtroom to answer for its multitude of sins. Reuben Massey did not care how the story was told, nor did he care what the public thought at that moment. To the tort bar, it was important to react as if his company was shaken and frightened. He understood trial lawyers. 3 days after the hearing in Chicago, Nicholas Walker phoned Jerry Alessandros and suggested they arrange a secret meeting between the company and the biggest tort firms involved with Crayox. The purpose of the meeting would be to throw open the door to full-scale negotiations. Alessandros jumped at the idea and gravely vowed total silence. From the 20 or so years he'd been dealing with trial lawyers, Nicholas knew the meeting would not be a secret because one or more of the lawyers would tip the press. The following day, a blurb in the Wall Street Journal reported that Cymbal, Varick's principal insurance company, had been put on notice by the company that its reserve fund was about to be activated. Citing an anonymous source, the story went on to speculate that the only reason for such an action was to settle its Crayox mess. Other leaks followed, and the bloggers were soon declaring another victory for consumers. Since every trial lawyer worth his salt owned his own jet, the destination was no problem. With New York City deserted in August, Nicholas Walker secured a large meeting room on the 40th floor of a half-empty Midtown hotel. many of the trial lawyers were out of the office, off somewhere dodging the heat, but not a single invitation was declined. A large settlement was far more important than a few days of vacation. When they convened, 8 days after Judge Seawright set the date for the first trial, there were the 6 members of the plaintiff's litigation committee, plus another 30 trial lawyers, each with thousands of Crayox cases. Those as insignificant as Wally Figg did not even know of the meeting. Large young men in dark suits guarded the door to the meeting room and checked credentials. After a quick breakfast the first morning, Nicholas Walker welcomed everyone as if they were all salesmen for the same company. He even cracked a joke and got a laugh, but just under the surface there was tension. An avalanche of money was about to be unleashed, and the lawyers in the room were seasoned brawlers, ready for hand-to-hand combat. So far, there were 1,100 death cases, or, in other words, 1,100 cases in which the dead person's estate claimed Crayox was the cause. The medical proof was not exactly ironclad, though it was probably sufficient to become a question for a jury. Going along with their master plan, Nicholas Walker and Judy Beck spent almost no time discussing the basic issue of liability. They presumed, as did the horde on the other side, that the drug was responsible for 1,100 deaths and thousands of other injuries. After the formalities, Walker began by saying that Varick would like to nail down the value of each death case. Assuming that could be done, they would then move on to the non-death cases. Wally was on the shore of Lake Michigan in a small rental a block off the water with his darling Deanna, who was a knockout in a bikini, and he had just finished some pasta salad when his cell phone chirped. He saw the number, snatched the phone, and said, "Jerry, my man, what's going on?" Deanna, topless in a nearby lounge chair, perked up too. She knew that any call from Dear Jerry could be thrilling. Jerry explained that he was back in Florida after 2 days in New York, secret meeting and all, hammering things out with Varick. Tough bunch, just the death cases, you know, but anyway, lots of progress, no deal, no handshake, certainly nothing in writing, but it looks as though each death case will be somewhere around $2 million. Wally hummed along with an occasional smile at Deanna, who had inched closer. "Good news, Jerry, nice work. Let's chat next week." "What's up?" she cooed when the call was over. "Nothing, really, just an update from Jerry. Varick has filed a bunch of motions and he wants me to take a look." "No settlement?"
"Nope."
All she talked about now was the settlement.
Sure, it was his fault for running his big mouth, but the woman was obsessed with the settlement. She didn't have enough sense to play along as though she couldn't have cared less. No, she wanted details. She wanted money, and this was worrying Wally. He was already thinking of an exit strategy, just like his new hero, Oscar. Ditch the women before the money arrives. $16 million, 17% of which would flow into the coffers of Finley and Figg, a total of $2.7 million, of which Wally would take 50%. He was a millionaire. He crawled onto an air mattress and floated across the pool. He closed his eyes and tried not to grin. Soon Deanna was next to him, floating on the water, still topless, touching him occasionally to make sure he still needed her. They had been together for many months now, and Wally was finally getting bored. He was finding it more difficult to keep up with her constant demands for sex. He was, after all, 46, 10 years older than Deanna, though her actual birth date was a moving target. The day and month had been nailed down, but the year kept inching forward. He was tired and needed a break, and he was also concerned about her fascination with his Crayox money. It would be in his best interest to ditch her now, do the breakup routine, one he knew well, and get her out of his life and away from the money. This would not be easy and would take some time. Such a strategy would work well for Oscar, too. Paula Finley had hired an obnoxious divorce lawyer named Stam, and he was banging the war drums. During their first phone chat, Stam expressed surprise at how little money Oscar cleared from his law practice and went on to imply that money was being hidden. He probed into the murky world of fees paid in cash, but he got nothing from Wally, who knew that territory well. Stam mentioned the Crayox litigation, but got stiff-armed by Wally's well-rehearsed denials that Oscar was involved.
"Well, it looks suspicious," Stam had said. "Mr. Finley is willing to walk away with nothing but his car and clothes after 30 years of marriage."
"Oh, no," Wally had protested. "It makes perfect sense if you really got to know Paula Finley, your client."
They bickered for a while, as divorce lawyers do, then promised to talk later. As bad as Wally wanted the money, he decided to delay the actual receipt of the cash for several months. Do the paperwork now or in the next few weeks, keep it under wraps in court, then get rid of the women. For what was supposed to be the slowest month of the year, August was proving to be quite productive. On August 22nd, Helen Zink gave birth to an 8-pound girl, Emma, and for a couple of days her parents acted as though they had produced the first baby in history. Mother and child were in perfect health, and when they arrived home, all four grandparents were waiting, along with 24 friends. David took a week off and found it impossible to stay out of the little pink nursery. He was called back into action by an angry federal judge, one who evidently did not believe in vacations and was rumored to work 90 hours a week. Her name was Sally Archer, or Sudden Sal, as she had been aptly nicknamed. She was young and brash, extremely bright, and in the process of driving her staff into the ground. Sudden Sal ruled quickly and wanted every lawsuit settled the day after it was filed. David's labor case had been assigned to Archer, who had minced no words in voicing her low opinion of Cicero Pipe and its sleazy practices. Under pressure from multiple arms of the federal government, and Sudden Sal as well, the prime contractor convinced its sub, Cicero Pipe, to clean up its labor mess and legal problems and get on with its portion of the water treatment plant. The criminal charges against the would-be arsonist, Justin Bardall, and others at the company would take months to untangle, but the wage and hour dispute could and would be wrapped up quickly. 6 weeks after filing the lawsuit, David hammered out a settlement that was hard for him to believe. Cicero Pipe agreed to pay to each of his five clients the lump sum of $40,000. In addition, the company would pay $30,000 each to another 36 undocumented workers, most Mexican and Guatemalan, who had been paid $200 a week for at least 80 hours. Because of the notoriety of the case, said notoriety being greatly enhanced by Oscar's vigorous defense of his own property and the ensuing arrest of the wealthy owner of Cicero Pipe, the hearing before Sudden Sal attracted some reporters. Judge Archer began by recapping the lawsuit, and in doing so, guaranteed she would be quoted by describing Cicero Pipe's abuses as slave labor. She lashed out at the company, rebuked its lawyers, who were actually pretty nice guys in David's opinion, and in general grandstanded for 30 minutes as the reporters scribbled away. "Mr. Zink, are you satisfied with this settlement?" Her Honor inquired. The agreement was in writing. The deal had been cut a week earlier. The only remaining issue was attorney's fees. "Yes, Your Honor," David said quietly. The three lawyers for Cicero Pipe hunkered down, almost afraid to look up. "I see that you have submitted a request for attorney's fees," Sudden Sal observed as she looked at some paperwork. 58 hours. I would say, in light of what you have accomplished and the money you've obtained for all these workers, that your time has been well spent." "Thank you, Your Honor," David said. He was standing at his table. "What's your hourly rate, Mr. Zink?" "Well, Your Honor, I've been anticipating that question, and the truth is that I really don't have an hourly rate. My clients can't afford to pay by the hour." Judge Archer nodded. "In the past year, have you billed anyone by the hour?" "Oh, sure. Until last December, I was a senior associate at Rogan Rothberg." The judge laughed into her microphone and said, "Oh, boy, talk about experts at the hourly rate. What were you worth back then, Mr. Zink?" David shifted uncomfortably and shrugged. "Judge, the last time I worked on the clock, the client was billed $500 an hour." "Then you're worth $500 an hour." Sudden Sal scribbled for a few seconds, then announced, "Let's round it off to $30,000. Any objections, Mr. Lattimore?" The defendant's chief counsel stood and paused and pondered what to say. Objecting would do no good because the judge was clearly in the other camp. His client was getting clobbered so badly anyway, what was another $30,000? And if Lattimore expressed misgivings about the fees, he knew that Sudden Sal would hit him with a quick, "Well then, Mr. Lattimore, what's your hourly rate?" "Sounds reasonable," Lattimore said. "Good. I want all funds exchanged within 30 days. Court's adjourned." Outside the courtroom, David spent time with three reporters, patiently answering their questions. When he was finished, he drove to the apartment of So and Lewin, where he met his three Burmese clients and broke the news that they would soon receive checks for $40,000 each. The message wasn't clear in translation, and So repeated himself several times to convince the men. They laughed and thought it was all a joke,
but David refused to laugh along. When reality set in, two of the three began crying. The third was too shocked. David tried to make the point that they had earned the money with their sweat and labor, but this, too, did not translate well. David was in no hurry. He had been away from his new daughter for all of 6 hours, a record, but she wasn't going anywhere. He sipped tea from a tiny cup and chatted with his clients, glowing in his first major victory. He had taken a case that most lawyers would refuse. His clients had bravely stepped out from the shadows of illegal immigration to confront a wrong, and David had coaxed them into it. Three little guys a million miles from home, abused by a big company with plenty of big friends, nothing between them and more abuse except a young attorney and a court of law. Justice, with its flaws and ambiguities, had prevailed in a magnificent way. Driving to the office alone, David was filled with immense pride and a sense of accomplishment. He hoped to have many great wins in the future, but this one would always be special. Never in 5 years with the big firm had he ever felt so proud of being a lawyer. It was late, and the office was deserted. While he was on vacation, checking in occasionally with the latest Crayox update, Oscar was AWOL for a few days, not even Rochelle knew where he'd gone. David checked his phone messages and mail, putted around his desk for a few minutes, then got bored with it. As he locked the front door, a police car pulled to a stop in front of the building. Friends of Oscar's, keeping an eye on the place. David waved at the two officers and headed home.
Chapter 32. Fresh from a long Labor Day weekend, Wally wrote to his client Iris Klopek. Dear Iris, as you know, our trial is set for next month, October 17th to be exact, but this is not something to worry about. I spent most of last month negotiating with the attorneys at Varick, and we have arrived at a very favorable settlement. The company is in the process of offering a sum in the neighborhood of $2 million for the wrongful death of your husband, Percy. This offer is not official, but we expect to receive it in writing within the next 15 days. I know this is considerably more than the $1 million I promised, but nonetheless, I need your approval to accept this offer when it is formally put on the table. I'm quite proud of our little boutique firm. We are like David battling Goliath, but right now we're winning. Please sign the attached form authorizing the settlement and mail it back. Sincerely, Wallace T. Figg, attorney and counselor at law. He sent similar letters to the other seven clients in his wonderful little class of death cases, and when he finished, he kicked back in his swivel rocker, placed his shoeless feet on his desk, and once again contemplated the money. His dreams were interrupted, though, when Rochelle buzzed in with a curt, "That woman is on the phone. Please talk to her. She's driving me crazy." "Okay," Wally snapped and stared at the phone. Deanna was not going away quietly. During the drive home from Lake Michigan, he had picked a fight with her and managed to escalate it to the level of some serious name-calling. In the heat of the battle, he had announced that they were through, and for two tranquil days thereafter they did not speak. Then she showed up at his apartment drunk, and he relented and allowed her to sleep on the sofa.